Hello, and welcome back to the Stories from the Ashes podcast, where we pontificate on good books and the stories that define and refine us. I'm your host, Amber Sauter, and I am here today with guest author Megan Sabin, the author of Something Better Coming. Welcome, Megan.
Thank you. I am so glad to be here.
We're so excited to have you. The way we try to get to know our new friends is by asking three most influential books, which I know is an incredibly complicated question for readers, and it's a way to also make you just hate me out the gate, but it's not the three most, it's just three of the most.
Okay. So. Well, as much as I would love to, you know, break it down by genre and decade,
Yes.
The three that I would, that I usually point to as my most formative books, are Till We Have Faces by C.S. Lewis, Stepping Heavenward by Elizabeth Prentice, and The Hiding Place by Corrie Ten Boom. Because in all three of those, they are stories of women who are struggling to know God. And I love how honest they are in that struggle and genuine wrestling through sanctification or just knowing the love and compassion of God as a father over years of their lives. And I've actually dramatized Till We Have Faces and The Hiding Place on stage. So I feel like those are really a part of me. I never got to do Stepping Heavenward, but every time I reread that book, I think she's still talking about me.
Yeah. So that's beautiful. I will say that Stepping Heavenward inspired a post in our Facebook group on books that betrayed us.
Really?
I have. And here's why. It was not the book's fault. It was the person who gave me the book's fault. I was told it was a true story. And I was about halfway through when I found out it wasn't. And I was just like, I couldn't recalibrate. Like, I could not reconcile what I thought I knew with what I now knew. And so I put it down and I was probably 16 at the time. And I've never read it since. But I've wanted to because I had really been enjoying it and loving it. But my brain was just like, oh, no, like I can't at this halfway through point switch from thinking it's true to it not being true. And so I want to read it with my daughters. And I think that we may this year. And yes, I will definitely tell them this is not a factual story.
It is
a true story,
yes,
but not based on some one particular person's life.
It's more like it's more of a memoir. So no, it's not autobiographical, but I think that that gave Prentice a little more freedom, you know, in the narrative, to reflect her life experience in a very genuine way without having to be perfectly authentic. Now, if you want to read her collection of letters, you could read More Love to Thee, which is about 2 inches thick. I have not read it yet, but every time I sing her hymn when we're at church, it just really moves me again. And
which hymn is her hymn for people who don't know?
More Love to Thee. Okay. More love to Thee, O Christ, more love to Thee. Hear now the prayer I make on bended knee. This be my earnest plea, more love, O Christ, to Thee. More love to Thee, more love to Thee.
It's a beautiful one.
It is. So yes, by all means, I encourage
you. Well, I love reading letters, so I may start there.
And then you could compare the two, but just read Stepping Heavenward with delight.
Yeah.
Do that first.
Yeah, I'll do that. Thank you. Well, I'd love to talk about your beautiful Easter picture book, Something Better Coming. And I will tell you, I go into any book based on the Bible that is for children with much trepidation.
That's why.
And so the illustrations looked beautiful when I was seeing them on Instagram, and the concept seemed great, and I was familiar with other projects you'd worked with. And so I was like, I think that this one might be trustworthy, but like ever since I read a children's Bible that said some bad men hurt Jesus, and that was basically the end of the crucifixion story, I'm always like, oh man, how are they going to handle this? Is it actually something I want to be formative for how my children view Jesus and the biblical narrative? And so I read it and I loved it. I read it aloud the day it came, I read it aloud to all the teens that were in the house. So those were my girls and Amanda's daughter, and everyone loved it and they loved looking at the pictures. And it's a beautiful, hope-filled story told in verse. But I really was struck by how much of Jesus's life had been marked by death and resurrection before we even get to the story of his death and resurrection. And I knew it, like I knew those stories, but I had never made that very clear connection that this was this repetitive thing that the disciples had seen, and now he's dead and they don't feel that there's a hope for a resurrection, and how that would have struck the disciples and all of his followers. So do you just want to talk about the story and why you decided to tell it from that angle and what your process was and all of that?
Sure. So you're giving me goosebumps just, you know, being impressed again with someone else's, like, thank you, I need this refreshing. So yeah. When I first started writing for Redeemed Reader, it was about 10 years ago. And one of my first assignments was to do a roundup of Easter picture books. And so I went to the library, I went to the local independent bookstore, I was looking everywhere, and all I could find that was for Easter was either books with themes of spring and chicks and bunnies and new life and, you know, eggs, and that's how it tied into Christian themes, or books that focused just on that one week of Christ's passion. And it was usually told from the perspective of an onlooker, like a boy or a donkey or something like that. And then it ended with the resurrection. And that just frustrated me, because I thought, no, it's part of a bigger story. The story doesn't end there and it doesn't begin there. And really it doesn't, you know, begin at the beginning of something better coming either. You know, it goes all the way back to Genesis.
Right.
But so I'm not quite sure how it happened. It just came and, you know, the words just started flowing during nap time and I couldn't stop writing it. And what happened is the Lord provided an agent right away, which was fantastic. And she started looking for a publisher, and she had a lot of health problems. She was not part of an agency. She was getting older. And after a few years, I didn't hear anything from her anymore. And I believe the Lord took her home. And so here I was, left with a book that, out of all my manuscripts that are still waiting to be published, is the one that I felt most passionately about for the sake of Christ's church, and for my own sake. And I had no idea who she had talked to. So when we had a pandemic and baseball was wiped off the calendar, I asked my husband, what would you think of my self-publishing Something Better Coming? And he agreed to that. Now, when I was young and wanted to, you know, be a writer, I remember interviewing an author and she said, don't ever self-publish your work, because if it's good enough, someone else will pay to publish it for you. So it always kind of had that stigma. And I know that if you publish your own work, it's like, it's so quote unquote easy to do these days, that it's hard to do it well and for anyone to take it seriously. But the Lord took care of all that. I talked to Ben Hatke, who's the author illustrator of Zeta the Space Girl. He was a visiting artist at Hollands University, where I got my master's in children's lit. And we live not too, we live within an hour from there. So we can go over there and hear all these amazing, you know, speakers. And he mentioned that self-publishing is becoming more widely accepted because the you know, the market has changed and the resources mm-hmm. have changed. I also would not have been so brave as to try it if I didn't know a man in our church who is extraordinarily gifted as an illustrator.
Yeah, Ryan Flanders did your illustrations, and they're just beautiful.
He did a phenomenal job, and I think I may have tried his patience a few times. Ryan, how's it going? Ryan, how's it going? but I had seen some of his other work where he had taken a biblical concept and put it in a visual narrative form. And I will send you a link to his Fine Art America website so that you can see some of his phenomenal work. And so I knew he could take a story and do what a good illustrator does, which is add the emotion and more to it. So the first illustration that he sent me is the one I used on the cover, which is rather unusual because it's a picture of a funeral. And that's not the standard for a, you know, for really any
for selling book. A children's book.
And when he sent it to me, I assumed, okay, this is just like, you know, it's part of the color. No, that was finished. But as he sent me more of the illustrations, as he finished them, I was so moved by the genuine emotion throughout the book, and the details he puts in there of like Jairus wringing his hands in grief. You see the muscles in Jairus's hands, and the joy and the sorrow is such a strong contrast. And he did a wonderful job in showing different perspectives, where sometimes you're standing in the crowd, and other times you are in the dirt with Jairus at Jesus' feet.
Yeah.
And then when Christ is on the cross, you are looking down at the cross as the centurion is looking up at Christ. Mm-hmm. And so it was like a video camera. You really feel like you're watching something unfold in stills. Yeah.
I often tell people when they're talking about like, how do you pick a good, like, how do you know if it's a good picture book and if the illustrations are, you know, good, true, and beautiful or whatever, like whatever the standards are that people are talking about. How do you tell? And the first thing that always comes to mind is, does this work as an audiobook? I think that really excellently done picture books don't work the same as audiobooks.
That's true, but they should work as some kind of a, almost like a video, you know?
Yeah.
I was recently reading Show Me a Story, which is a series of interviews compiled by Leonard Marcus. And he talked with a number of prominent award-winning illustrators. Mm-hmm. And what I noticed that a lot of them had in common was a background in theater or in film or in television. So when you look at their work, you can see the characters are like just paused in the middle of going somewhere or something happening. It's not like a tableau where everyone is posed and sitting there, you know, waiting
for still life.
Paint. Right. Exactly. Exactly. So anyway, knowing an illustrator that I could trust to do well and just leave it in his hands was a huge part. The lily was all his development. And I just love how he, you know, he put that in there, and you don't really think about it until you go back through. But he told me that he felt both spiritual warfare and also entered into worship when he was doing these illustrations. And
I believe it.
That's why it was such a privilege to, you know, to give it to him. And I have said from the beginning, this is the Lord's book. It's not mine. So the Lord really led the way. And about the time that I was thinking about doing this, I interviewed Jill Morgan from Purple House Press, mm-hmm. named reader. And after that, I said, by the way, who do you use as a printer? So yeah. she connected me with the printer. And then I did a Kickstarter campaign. And that is the only one I plan to do in my life. That was enough. But I got through it. It's done. And so the first 2,000 copies went relatively quickly.
Yeah.
And then I was getting ready to order another 2,000 when a local pastor read it and said, did you have it professionally edited? And I said, well, I tried, but I didn't mm-hmm. really know, again, who I could trust, you know, whose judgment I could really work with. And he said, well, I know an editor, you know, he said, I think this is 95% where it could be, but it mm-hmm. could be a little better. And then it could be yeah. farther. And I said, thank you for your honesty.
Yeah.
Because I felt the same way. And yeah. I just didn't have the courage or know what to do. But again, right. the Lord had provided. Mm-hmm. And so he gave it to an editor through his sister, who's a well-known author. And it gave me time to make a few revisions in the text mm-hmm. just because I wanted to. And
yeah.
it was just an interesting experience to, you know, be all of the, you know, to play all the roles.
Yeah.
But not something that I want to make a career out
of. Wow, that's a great story. I love hearing people's experiences with publishing stories that they have told, because I really feel that it's like you were saying, like self-publishing is becoming more widely accepted. And so you're seeing that people's journeys are not just all cookie cutter anymore. And it's so nice for authors and illustrators to hear of the options that are out there and what has worked for different people. And I think it can give them confidence if their journey is not looking like they expected it to, or like the self-help book that they read on the topic told them it would right. look, that it can just help them to right. feel a little freedom and breathing room
right.
in the experience.
Right.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for sharing about that experience yes. with us. You yes. mentioned a few times in that story, Redeemed Reader. And that is a resource that our group recommends frequently in our Facebook group. But I would love for you to describe a little bit about what it is for our podcast listeners who may not be familiar.
Yes, I'd love to. So Redeemed Reader is a team of four of us. It was actually founded by Emily Witten and Janie Chaney, I think 13 years ago. I think we have a birthday in the next day or two. And it consists of Janie Chaney, who is a senior columnist for World Magazine, and she has written a number of middle grade novels that have been on the Junior Library Guild lists. So she's an excellent fiction writer. She's the author of Wordsmith and all of those writing curriculum books. And she is just such a wise reviewer for Redeemed Reader. And then there's Betsy, who was a dear friend of mine at Covenant College. And she and I took a children's literature class together and learned about truth and story in literature that changed the course of our lives.
Hmm.
So she and I started a blog called Literarity, actually, years ago. And then we were picked up by Redeemed Reader because we were trying to do the same thing. Mm-hmm. And Janie and Emily wanted to join forces so that we could cover more ground. And then Haley Morrell is, I'm trying to think of what her title is, but she started as an intern and did such a good job with the newsletter that she came on full time. And so she mostly does the newsletter, but we all do book reviews. So our theme with Redeemed Reader is we're reading ahead for you, because mm-hmm. no parents, especially not me, none of us can read all of the children, all of the books our children want to read, or know how to decide when we are looking at the library or at the bookstore, or if someone is talking about a book, how do I know if this is something suitable for my child? And it might be suitable for your child, but not someone else's child. Maybe one child in your family and not another one. But we are not a book recommendation service. We're not telling you whether or not you should read the book. We are giving you information about the book. We're telling you what it's about and include considerations so that you can decide for yourself if this is a good fit for this child right now or ever. And we try to write positive reviews, but honest ones too. So we will let you know if there's language in a book or if there's something thematic that might be subtle, but it's maybe overlooked. Or if there's sexuality, how it's portrayed. Is it, you know, behind closed doors, you know, between a married couple, or is it something that is more graphic and parents might just need to know any of those things so that they can discuss them with their children and make wise decisions.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I love that. A lot of times people mistake what our group's purpose is, and our Facebook group's purpose is to help people curate and build their home libraries. And there is sharing of reviews of books that people have read that comes in with that. But a lot of times people will just think that we are a book review group or that we are a book recommendation group. And they'll just come with a book and be like, my kid picked this up at the library. Should I let them read it? And like you said, that's never anything that someone outside your family can answer for you because we don't know your kid. We don't know what their sensitivities are. We don't know what family triggers are. We don't know if you just recently lost someone in your family and your kid doesn't want to read a book about somebody losing that person. And you know, what your kid's childhood traumas are that you're working through. And so what your family values are, right? Like some people, not that this is wrong or right, but like some people have completely dry families and have no interest in reading any books that have even a reference to alcohol, whereas other families are like, you know, as long as they aren't glorifying alcoholism and drunkenness, like we're okay with alcohol being in the story. And so I don't know most of these people, you know, I don't know most of the 17,000 people in our group from Adam. And so I can't just tell you that. All we can do is offer content considerations and tell you what stood out to us when we read the book. And then the parents have that responsibility too. But we do often send them for more modern books over to Redeemed Reader and say, you should go check out what Redeemed Reader has if your kids are looking for books from the library right now, and see what, see if they had a review on that book or if there's other books there that your kid would like.
Right. And of course we can't cover all the books that are coming out because, you know, there are only four of us and all four of us seem to go from one major life event to another. So it's hard to fit it in with, you know, between the cracks. But but for example, the ALA awards were announced a couple weeks ago, and we watched them, and you know, we were discussing it on Slack afterwards. And it's it's wonderful to see how many of them someone on the team had read in advance. But then afterwards, we were saying, okay, I'll get these, you get those, and then we can read them and let parents know, hey, this is why you're going to see them more more prominently displayed and talked about and so on. And what we are concerned about, too, is not just don't ever read books that have content that you do not approve of. Because our children are growing up in a different culture where they're faced with different things. And if they are able to encounter those things in a book and you can talk about them, then that's a healthy way to help them grow in their discernment. In loving their neighbor and not to just shun someone who is who does not have so much light that you know, that Christ has given us, yeah. But what we're always wrestling with is how can we love our neighbor through mm-hmm. literature and love our readers so that, you know, so that we can help encourage them not to be afraid of those books.
Yes. Yeah. I always say read it before you need it.
Right.
That's my belief system, especially with developing a theology of suffering within a family.
Yeah.
And I think that books can be so helpful in giving your kids pegs to hang harder conversations on because they've been introduced to them at a kid-friendly level or even at a really hard level that was a challenge, but you guys all talked through it and worked through it. So now it's not a shock when right. that's an experience that they're having. I don't know if I've shared it on the podcast before, I think possibly in season one, but Pride and Prejudice is something that, you know, our kids were completely raised on starting at like age two for my oldest. And the story of Lydia running away with Wickham was so necessary after my dad passed away and my sisters went into deep mourning and started making unadvisable life choices. Mm-hmm. And one of them ended up pregnant and we were able to like easily have the conversations right. because of this like gentle telling of Lydia's right. indiscretion with Wickham to be able to be like, you know, people just make decisions sometimes that are not wise and they're not looking to the future and not thinking of the permanent consequences to themselves and to the people around them and the people in their families when they make these decisions. And it happens, but like we were able to just tell it to them at a kid-friendly level,
right.
this really hard, complicated situation because they'd already seen a version of it
right.
played out in a story that they loved. And so I'm just like eternally grateful to Pride and Prejudice for making this really hard conversation accessible
yeah.
to my kids.
Well, and what we're especially looking for is redemptive themes in them
mm-hmm.
and how God can take any kind of situation and turn it for good. Now we don't yeah. know what happened after Pride and Prejudice. You know, did Lydia ever, you know, repent? Was she ever reconciled with her family? We don't know. But we yeah. know that other good things did happen. And mm-hmm. so in literature, we see that there is good and there is evil and there is fall and there is redemption. Yeah. And so we're always looking for truth and story
yeah.
that will communicate those things because this is our Father's world. And yeah. the best books are going to be those that portray a difficult situation appropriately and honestly, but mm-hmm. ends with some kind of redemption and some kind of hope.
Yeah. Well, I would argue that Darcy redeems Lydia.
Yes. Yes, he
and
does.
So,
yes.
So there's
he is
there's
redeemed
even...
while he is redeeming her. So in a way, yes. he's, you know, he's kind of a kinsman redeemer, like
right,
Boaz.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, we don't know that she has a heart change, but he right. sure does.
Yes.
So does Lizzie as a result.
Yes. So. Yeah. So I love this. I love that story.
You know that our actions do have consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, perhaps Lydia came to, you know, repentance later on. We hope that she didn't stay a silly girl forever. Maybe she did. Mm-hmm. But even if she, let's imagine that her heart was changed, but Wickham's wasn't. Well, that's right. very authentic for the world that we live in, too. So, you know, you can go in lots of different directions once you have a good book to start with.
Yes. Yeah. And stories are true, right? Like a good story is a true story and life is true. And it's just a giant story as well. And so you can just find those parallels and pull them together.
Yes. Yes. But sometimes you have to look harder for them than others. And
yeah,
there are, you know, people who are trying to deny the reality of truth and, and just leave an open ended, ending I think of when I was a children's librarian before I got married, I remember reading Philip Pullman's The Golden Compass trilogy, mm-hmm. and also reading the books by Lemony Snicket. And Pullman's books were very well written, and I found mm-hmm. myself really, you know, getting caught up in the story. But because he was attacking religion, which,
right.
you know, wasn't really, you know, the most godly manifestation mm-hmm. of Christ's church, but he was attacking religion. And so I had to keep checking where my loyalties lay, because
yeah.
otherwise I would have been swept away with the quality of his writing. And
yeah.
in Lemony Snicket, I was really enjoying the first few books. And then at the end of the series, it all went off into a big postmodern question mark. There mm. was no ending. And it was mm-hmm. all a big joke. And it was mm-hmm. so frustrating as a reader to feel like mm-hmm. there's no resolution. And that is not true with a capital T.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I like that. We've been having some big conversations in our community recently on truth, beauty, and goodness, and on the fact that we hold a hard line and we are not open to recommendations of spicy books in our community. And we don't even want them with a declaration that this is a spicy book. Like, that's not what we're looking for in our home library building of true, good, and beautiful books. And we're not judging people that are reading them. We're not saying you can't read these. We're just saying those recommendations are easily available elsewhere.
Right.
And so go elsewhere for them. And so we've been having a lot more questioning on, like, how does one define good, true, and beautiful? And that bigger discussion of, like, the transcendentals is going on in our moderating group right now, as we're trying to come up with a metric, but, like, how do you metric goodness, truth, and beauty? Like, it's this impossible thing where it's like, you know it when you see it, you know, like, but so many people don't know it when they see it. And it has to do with, like, training your eye and your spirit and your soul. And it's so complicated, but you told me that you love talking about truth and story. And so I was like, well, that'll fit perfectly with all of these internal musings that I've been having this week, especially with this back on the front burner of the group. So talk to me about it. Please, Megan, talk to me about truth and story.
I will do my best. So I was thinking about, a couple nights ago, how do you describe truth and story? And you're right, it is hard to define, but you know what, when you see it, but what if you're not in the place where you can recognize it? So right. I think the first thing that I would say is, when banks are teaching their tellers to recognize counterfeit money, they make them handle the real thing over and over and over again, because then you know there's something off when you come across counterfeit money. And so the more excellence you read, which does not mean that you only have to read classics that are 100 years old or 50 years old, because there's some really good literature that is being published right now.
And also to clarify, there's some really trashy literature that was published 50 and 100 years ago.
Yes, very moralistic literature. Mm-hmm. There's a book that Betsy and I have been dipping in and out of for a while called The Feminization of American Culture. I think that's the right title. And forgive me, but the last time I listened to Five Little Peppers and How They Grew, which I used to really enjoy when I was growing up, it's not a trashy book, okay?
Right.
But last time that we listened to it, I happened to also be reading The Feminization of American Culture. And I realized this is an example of a book where the little girl is the savior of the grumpy old man.
Mm-hmm.
And there's very much a moralistic kind of goodness in books that were written 100 years ago. And there is nothing, you know, there's certainly nothing wrong with morals and with virtue, and they are to be glorified, but they come from Christ, not from a child's innocence. Okay.
Yeah.
And we see that in a lot of other older books that have been very popular, and they're on a lot of lists because, well, I think that one list breeds another, but they're, you know, they're considered safe because they're clean. But does that mean right. that they are true? And does that mean that yeah. they are good?
And is it even something that you want your kids to be emulating?
Right, right.
Because I tell my kids all the time, like, one way to tell tricky people is adults should not be asking stranger young children for help.
That's
right. Like, they shouldn't be coming to you if they lost their puppy. They should be coming right. to another adult or their friend. But then we see all of these books where, yes, the young females or the young boys are the rescuers of these old people. Mm-hmm. And is that something that we want our children to think?
Benefactors. And so
yeah, right?
It's
is that something we want our children to think is their goal in life or the reason they should be being polite and kind to elderly people right. is hoping some magical benefactor is around the corner.
Exactly. So there are,
or that it's their role to rescue adults. Right. Like, I tell my kids all the time, like, these are adult issues. These are kid issues. Right. You can be aware that adult issues are happening in the world around you, but that doesn't mean that they are your weight to carry or your job to fix.
Right. Right. And I think it also sets an unhealthy standard of behavior for children to, you know, try to always be as good as yeah. the model child in literature, rather than Christ, and rather than recognizing how to deal with their own sin, mm-hmm. because that's really more helpful for, you know, for our children. Betsy has a couple of really good posts on Redeemed Reader. One of them is the 6 risks of reading old books. And she's not saying don't read them. Let me make that very right. clear. She's not saying yeah. don't read them. But you need to read those with a discerning eye, as mm-hmm. well as reading new ones wisely. Mm-hmm. And she's also reviewed The Keeper of Lost Cities, which is hugely popular because apparently it's squeaky clean. But mm-hmm. she points out in her review that at one point, I'm not sure how often, but the main character is by herself in a room with an older man. And that's mm-hmm. not a good idea. Now, a lot of children are not necessarily going to pick up on that, but it's something mm-hmm. that parents just need to be aware of, that it's in there. Right. So that if your child modeled. Really wants to read this book, okay, that's fine.
Yeah.
And then you can ask questions.
Right. Yeah. No, I definitely think that that's a very valuable thing, because I've talked before about being aware of whether your child is an emulator or not. Right. And especially with neurodivergencies, when you have kids that are reading to script from and to, because that's what I did as a kid. I couldn't figure out what was going on in the world around me, why people thought the way they did, why people behaved the way they did. So I read thousands of books yeah. in order to build this huge blueprint of humanity, and then to try to script how real humans, right? Like, that's what it felt like then, like how real humans would interact,
right?
And how to, you know, how to pass as a human in this world that, like, clearly did not approve of the way I was trying to just be as myself, right. and found me very confusing. But if I acted like these characters in these situations, then that would be okay. But yeah, there were a ton of situations where I did not have that that understanding of tricky people, right?
Right.
But kids were alone with adults all the time in all these stories that I read, because most of them were orphans, right? Like, isn't that the
right? Or the father trope? Was away or dead.
Exactly, or exactly.
The mother was away, or, you know, having to support the family or something.
Yes.
Right. So you had children.
Yeah, and so you have these unsupervised kids out doing whatever, and we were the generation of latchkey kids, right? So I wasn't a latchkey kid, but I definitely had free reign of the neighborhood. And yeah, there were a lot of situations where now I'm like, oh my goodness, the kids that I have now, a couple of them could really get into some serious trouble because they have no fear. They have no awareness of when people are doing things or saying, like, they don't even know when they're being bullied because they just are so trusting and believe the best in everyone. And so, so I'm like, yeah, those would not be safe stories for them at this point, you know?
Right.
So I definitely agree with that.
So let me tell you about how we talk about truth and story at Redeeming Theater. Okay. And this goes back over 20 years to when Betsy and I were at Covenant College, and we took this class in children's literature that was taught by the assistant librarian who I worked with. And one day in class, he explained to us that there is truth with a capital T, and that is God's truth. And that is absolutes. It is creation, fall, and redemption. And it is the world as God has ordained it. We could say it is the definition of marriage. It is the definition of humanity. It is the redemptive hope. All of those things. Anytime that you find any of those things in a book, it's a reflection of truth with a capital T. So then you have truth with a lowercase t. And those would be facts, mostly. And trying to think of some examples. There's nothing necessarily wrong with reading books that have truth with a lowercase t. And sometimes they're just, you know, the easy books to read, and they're fine. There's more more explanation and examples on a post I have on Redeemed Reader. But so you have truth with a capital T and truth with a lowercase t. Well, then you have story with a capital S and story with a lowercase s, okay? So story with a capital S are things like Pride and Prejudice, where it is so well told and it is so compelling and it moves you and it changes you and it lingers with you because it's so beautifully told. Well, then you have story with a lowercase s, which is some of the easier books that are, you know, they have a beginning and a middle and an end, but there's really nothing memorable about them. So what happens in books is you can have books with a capital T truth and capital S story. And you can, I'm sure, think of some examples of those. The first time that this really struck me was, well, for that class, I was, we had to read a bunch of children's books and write and keep a book of reviews. And when I read Voyage of the Dawn Treader for the first time when I was in college, I was sitting on the floor leaning against my bunk, and I read the end of the book where Aslan appears in the form of a lamb, and then he changes into a lion, and he's invited the children to come and have breakfast, and then he tells Edmund and Lucy that they're too old to come back. And Lucy's heart is broken because it's not Narnia, it's him. She says, how can we live never meeting you? And he says, but I am there, dear one. That is exactly why I brought you to Narnia, so that by meeting me here, you may know me there. I have another name there. And I just started weeping. And that was the first time that I really saw how truth and story could weave together so powerfully in literature.
Yeah.
But it's not always that obvious. Okay.
Right.
So, but there are many, 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 many examples of good books that may not be written by Christians, but because of common grace, the truth is there in story. Another example I would give of that would be something like Hecate Peg, which is one of my favorite picture books, where a mother is wise and brave for the sake of rescuing her children.
Yeah.
Fairy tales are loaded with truth and story. Loads.
Yeah.
So then you can also have lowercase t truth and lowercase s story. those are the books that you see at the doctor's office or at Dollar General or in many places where it's a story. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end, but there's nothing, you know, moved.
The substance.
Yes, exactly. Or it might be something like the I Spy books. Okay. Well, I guess, something like the I Spy books where they're fun and there's nothing wrong with them. Those books have a place too.
Yeah.
But, and you know, my boys wear our copies out, but they don't quite have the same lifelong significance that is going to grow with you as a capital T truth and story. Now,
I think that a really good example of a capital T truth story is Calvin and Hobbes.
Amen. Thank you. My reading curriculum. I have five boys.
Yeah.
Five boys, and all five of them have learned to read with Calvin and Hobbes and comic books and graphic novels.
Yep.
And
that's where my boys found their love of reading was Calvin and Hobbes.
I keep telling people you don't need a reading curriculum. You really
don't. And they memorized it. They just like memorized so many deep chunks. I would hear my 6-year-old at the time reciting stuff in the back, like theological debates in the back seat, running both sides of them. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And he's like, oh, Calvin and Hobbes just had that conversation. I was like, oh my gosh, this is like truth, like capital T truth being planted in his mind, soul, and, you know, spirit. And then it's going to bear fruit. These are things that as he continues aging, he wrestles with at a different level and a different amount of understanding and maturity. And then at different points, different things will click and he'll be like, this is what that meant. This is what that was talking about. But this is like, oh my goodness, if you can water the soil. And so whenever people are like, I don't know, there's this one episode where like they're watching something bad on TV. I'm like, you are missing the forest for the tree. Like this is a forest of capital T truth. Like
it is.
You've got to do it.
And you know, one other quick rabbit trail. When my boys and I are reading together, off and on we do this. Okay. This isn't a regular Charlotte Mason everyday thing. But one thing that we started doing is we kept a motif journal. And there are things like Short Heroes, Red Shoes, Animal Friends, you know, Hating School, you know, two people who seem to hate each other, but they're secretly in love. I mean, there are so many things on the page. And then we would just, every time we came across something, oh, Randy's Apprentice, there's a Short Hero. There are just lots of examples, but Calvin and Hobbes meets more classic motifs than any other book. It is really brilliant. So the thing about truth and story is that you can have capital T truth with lowercase s story.
Yeah.
Okay. And that I think is what often happens in books that come from, let's say inspirational books, okay? Mm-hmm. Or books that are produced by some Christian authors and publishers, that they're so concerned about being biblical and Christian and making sure that you don't miss the message,
right?
That the storytelling, the narrative gets compromised or watered down.
Yeah.
Or you can also have books with lowercase t truth and uppercase s story, such as the Philip Pullman books that I was talking about earlier,
right,
where there's just enough truth in there to be dangerous or to just, you know, it doesn't only have to be books that are, you know, that are dangerous. I think that there's a lot of narrative nonfiction that really well told. And so, you know, we would call it a capital S story, but it doesn't quite have the power of, you know, Pride and Prejudice or, or some of the greater classics.
Yeah. Yeah. I love listening to people debate like the mother, Mother Who, is that it? Like the mother, who, what, why, something like that.
Oh, yes. Yes. I don't have those.
Yeah. Like people debating like those or Burgess or
I've had Thurston some of them and they're fine.
I could not. I do not know how many times I started trying to read those to my kids and could not make it past the second page. Yeah. I'm like, I feel like this is dribble and it's hurting my brain.
Well, I got some people love that out of it, you know, at a used curriculum sale. Or maybe I blessed somebody else by passing it on. I don't remember. Yeah. But no, they didn't take up shelf space, you know, that's a valuable commodity in my house.
Yeah. I felt that there were so many better options.
Yes.
And I also don't want to waste my shelf space with things that are spoon feeding morals to my kids and not making them think by just telling them this is exactly what this story meant.
Right.
And I really liked the book, which surprised me because of how much I disliked all of those older books. And again, sometimes we can feel a little like for the most part, the older books are going to be better than the newer books. Right. And we can forget that really good stories are still being written today. Mm-hmm. But I was not, because of how much I was not a fan of those older nature stories in so many cases, I did not think I was going to enjoy A Year in the Big Old Garden, The Big Old Garden Stories by James Whitmer. I really enjoyed that. They were humorous. They were completely relatable to what we've seen animals do in our backyard. Yeah. They were silly without being stupid.
Right. You know? Right.
And and the audiobook reader is excellent.
Interesting.
And so it was our audiobook for the littles for a few months. And I really enjoyed it. Like I would chuckle along and I didn't feel like we were being spoon-fed anything, but we were able to be like, dude, that was some serious pride going on there, you know?
That reminds me of Bird Life in Winkton. Did you ever
see I those? Didn't.
When we went to visit my grandparents, there wasn't a whole lot to do. So I typically reread Bird
Life in Winkton. That was my grandparents' and great-grandparents' experience. Read every word in that house.
So these books are out of print. I'm sorry, but I think there are still there may still be some copies out there. But they were kind of parables about these birds and their different characters and their interactions, and they were very much in keeping with the kind of bird that was in the story. But you also very much saw the tendencies of certain church members, you know, like to gossip or
something
like that. And they were really well done. I should read those to my boys.
Yeah.
I read Whitmer's book.
Yeah, I'm going to look those up too. This was great. And you're going to have to come back more because I know that you probably have so much more to say about truth and story. And it's such a great conversation. And I think that the more we engage with these ideas, right? I'm sorry, what?
I was going to say, I haven't even gotten to talk about the mug analogy.
Oh, well, tell me it. I'm ready. Give me the mug analogy.
Right. I had it in my mind and then it's been going all over.
I love analogies. Go for it.
So a couple nights ago, I was thinking, well,
as long as you don't just spoon feed me the moral.
No. You'll be able to figure it out while you're sitting there eating at Starbucks. Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that you have a particular mug that is your favorite because it has memories or it feels good or there's something about it that makes it the one that you always choose. And if it's dirty, you'll wash it rather than have to pick another mug. Okay.
Yeah.
So I have several of these and I have realized that I am rather particular about which beverage goes into which of my three favorite pottery mugs.
Yes.
And there's something about the feel of it. There's something about the weight of it, something about the comforting memory and associations. It might be or it could be a teacup and saucer that was an heirloom or that always brings back memories. So if you think of the mug as a story, that is the vessel that holds the truth. okay?
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. the truth might be, it might be a gentle healing herbal blend or something like that. It the story might be the honey that sweetens, you know, the herbs that might be a little bit bitter, or maybe you've got something robust in that mug, but somehow you want to have the right way to drink it, right? Or maybe you have a really frothy and decadent hot chocolate in there. The mug makes it taste better, right?
Yes.
Okay. Whatever is inside, the form matters. Well, that would be truth and story with capitals. And then truth and story in lowercase would be Swiss Miss hot chocolate made with water instead of milk
and yes.
styrofoam cup.
It's so true. Or even like then you get your combinations, right? Right. Swiss Miss put in your favorite mug. It does not belong there. No, it is not the same experience at
the
all.
The mug cannot make it taste better.
Yes.
And a really like good, you know, really good herbal blend or a really good coffee put in a styrofoam cup.
Yeah.
It's just, it doesn't taste right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nope. That's a really good analogy. I like that. Well, thank you so much for sharing that with us and helping us to frame it in our minds, what it can look like. So again, Megan's book, Something Better Coming, she has generously offered us a discount code until Easter. And so that will be in the show notes for people interested in looking for that. And do you have any, I was just thinking, sometimes people's experiences with the publishing process change as time goes on. And you said that the pastor had recommended doing the last 5% and how that had given you time to do some edits. So you mentioned your first printing. Are you on a second printing run? Were there any changes made in between those runs?
So what happened is when I do have a second printing that is available. And it was interesting, after I ordered my first print run, I somehow realized that it was written in iambic heptameter. I didn't
you plan realized this. It then. Yes. I love that.
I did not plan this, okay? Why iambic heptameter? I don't know. And there's a refrain in the book that keeps coming up that is not in the same meter. But a friend of mine who's a musician said, oh, you should see if you can find a hymn in the hymnal because, you know, you can look it up by meter.
Mm-hmm.
And so I looked it up and realized that you can sing Something Better Coming to any common meter tune.
Oh, wow.
Like Amazing Grace.
Wow, that's like one of those things that just like you can't plan it, no, right?
You can't, but I think
that's the Holy Spirit working through you, a willing vessel.
It is, exactly.
In creation. That,
like I said, it has been God's project from the beginning.
Yeah.
And I think it was just years of singing hymns and things like that that just became the most natural.
Internalized it. Right, yeah.
Exactly. And so the problem was, first of all, I didn't know what to do with a chorus. Or with a refrain. And some of the lines kind of broke off in the wrong place. So when I had a chance to revise it, and I also went ahead and hired a professional book designer for the second edition, and he didn't change much, but he did make it a little more polished and finished. So I got to tweak the text so that you could sing the whole thing to Amazing Grace. Although I have found other tunes that there's a there's a free download. You don't even have to give me your email. But on my website, there's a free download so that you can find out like what Bible stories are referenced and how the hymns would work, at least in the second edition. And it suddenly struck me one day. The refrain fits the doxology.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's awesome. Thank you so much for sharing that. We will link to those resources on your website too for people that are interested in the book or interested in seeing the poetry version of of how that all worked out. That's just absolutely incredible.
And I did realize that after this one, I did not want to publish all my own work. And so I sent out another manuscript to a publisher, and that one is due in next January. And then the Lord provided me an agent to take some of my other works. So
that's thrilling. Really
getting some different, different sides.
Yeah.
Experience. It's very humbling.
I'm so excited for you and excited for us as the readers that these books are coming. Do you have the ability to share the title of the January book?
Yes, it's called New House, New Home. And it is, it's very different than Something Better Coming. I have another, I'd say a companion manuscript to Something Better Coming that I'm still working on, but that's taking a while. But New House, New Home is based on our experience of building our house and watching it go up. And I've gotten to see the illustrations and they're really cute. But when we moved into our new house, we gave my then 5-year-old a hammer and tool bag for Christmas. And he really, really wanted to hang up pictures on the wall. And we kept saying, okay, not yet, not yet, not yet. Well, my husband and I went to lay down for a nap one afternoon, and we heard this bam, 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 right up to the wall. So now there is a nail hole at a 5-year-old's eye level. It was right in the fresh drywall.
Yo.
The Lord gave me grace to turn my horror into, oh, thank you.
Yeah.
And so, of course, that turned into a book. And
yeah, that's awesome. Did you hang anything on it?
Well, he had drawn a picture of my mommy and me on the back of our pastor's expense report. So I couldn't keep that, but I did take a picture of, you know, his beaming face and, you know, being next to him. And
oh, that's awesome.
Made a sweet memory.
Nice. One of my friends framed her children's crayon work on the wall.
Yes.
Put a little artist label on it. So. It just reminds me of that. Well, we've been wrapping up our episodes with talking about what people do for self-care in dark wintering seasons. And when I mentioned that to you, you responded, well, what about an awakening spring? And that they're probably the same for you. Can you talk a little bit about that real quick?
Well, you know, considering that wintering is a season of life, and it may be a day, you know, some days are brighter than others. And my favorite relaxing activity is knitting. That I think is what I go to most to just kind of unwind, and I can either, you know, be with people and doing something, or just kind of get lost in, you know, the rhythm. And, you know, there are psychological benefits to the, you know, going back and
forth. Yes.
But really, I just like to see yarn making interesting things and just seeing how the pattern unfolds. So, you know, I guess it's a image of life too, that, you know, we're still a work in progress and the design is still unfolding.
Yeah, that's beautiful. So how would you contrast a dark wintering season with an awakening spring?
There's something better coming.
Yeah. Yep. Amen.
And I think just knowing through the dark wintering that we do have certain hope, and that there would not be something better coming if Christ had not repeatedly shown his power over death. And so I'm grateful that I wrote the book, because other people remind me of this. And and that has really been a wonderful encouragement to my soul, that we may still be waiting for the awakening spring. We may still be in the cycle of, you know, going through the seasons, but that ultimately that new life and our hope is coming.
Yeah. I have ongoing conversations about suffering with my eldest. She has a chronic illness, and really, like, her whole life, I feel like we've just moved from one trauma to the next as a family, with the hurricane, with the house fire, with, you know, with friends moving, with us moving, with, in the first few years of her life, we lost a lot of people, including my dad. And so we've had 6 miscarriages. So just all the, and she's the eldest, right? So, like, she knows everything and carries all of this. Yeah, all this, and internalizes it, because she's like Jane in Pride and Prejudice, where Elizabeth is like, I don't even know what's going on inside my sister. She keeps it even from me, you know, and like, I'm probably the person closest to my eldest daughter, and she keeps so much from me, you know, like, it's just deep inside her. And so we talk about suffering and hope a lot. And I'm always telling her, you know, like, my teen years were very hopeless, and I would not be here if I had not at that time believed deep in my bones that I would see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living.
Yes.
And that's what this something better coming reminds me of, is that the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living, and his faithfulness to his promises and to his people, and how he showed his love for other humans while he was here walking among us as a human.
Yes.
So I really love that book. It's at the top of our Easter recommendation book list. I like all the bunny books and all of that as much as the next person. Yeah, they do. But this one, I really think, like, if you're going to get one book on the true meaning of Easter, this is the one that Reshelving Alexandria recommends. And we really appreciate you coming and sharing with us about it.
Oh, it's been a delight.
So all of these books that we've talked about will be in the show notes, and the links to Redeemed Reader and where you can find Megan's reviews, and to Megan's site where you can find more information about the book and the music that would go with the different beautifully timed out lyrics of the text. And remember, everyone, the stories are truer than true.
Amen.